with respect to automatic train control. Are there any other items for the agenda? Hearing none, we will move forward with that. Before we start on Mr. Doherty's report, I particularly want to thank Mr. Sorrells and the management team for all their efforts over the last couple of days with respect to Hurricane Sandy. I think we were lucky. We escaped the brunt of it as compared to some of our friends to the north. But I think it was an evidence of being prepared, working with other agencies that had involvement, like Office of Personnel Management and the jurisdictions. We're obviously grateful to the Weather Service for their updates. By the way, tomorrow is the first meeting of a panel that I've been put on. Actually, I'm chair, looking at the management of the Weather Service and how they perform. I think it's a good time to be doing that. I think in the idea of safety first and safety foremost, shutting down the system was the appropriate management decision. Employee safety, customer safety has to be the first order of business. But we're also have learned, and others have learned to the north, that shutting down is the best way to be sure you will be able to come back and not have incurred, you know, serious damage, even though the damage is serious. So all of our employees in each of the operations and throughout the authority worked through the storm, monitoring the impacts, delivering updates. The information to the public, I think, was clear and frequent. And we just want to thank you for that. I also, as I've said, want to recognize that our region was very much spared the worst of the storm's effects, although, as we were talking earlier, we need to be thinking about the future and whether the next storm or the storm after that produces a surge up the Chesapeake and up the Potomac. We could be seriously deluged, and we need to think about that. But our thoughts and prayers go to our colleagues, particularly my former colleagues at the MTA and Rich's colleagues at Jersey Transit. They have weeks and months of work ahead of them to get back in place. And I would ask at this time, too, that we observe a moment of silence for those citizens and first responders who lost their lives in this particular event. Thank you. We have the minutes from the previous meeting. Can I have a motion to approve the minutes? A second? All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. And before Mr. Doherty provides his report, which I think was much enhanced this time with the written material that appropriately went along with the slides, and I'd encourage people to look at those closely. I think we are seeing better information. We're also seeing improvement on the key indicators, recognizing that is a result of a lot of hard work, not just in the safety department, but throughout the organization. So in this quarter's report, which I'll ask Mr. Doherty to present, we, I think, are seeing the results of significant investment in time and money and policy that we have begun to put in place. Mr. Doherty?
Thank you, Chairman Downey, and good morning, members of the board, and thank you for the nice intro. And it certainly has been a great team effort from everybody involved. In fact, as we start with our employee injury rate, certainly one of the things I wanted to note that this quarter's employee injury rate is the lowest recorded in the past 2 years. So that's certainly something that's an improvement. Our employee injury rate of 4.17 injuries per 200,000 hours worked, with a year-to-date rate of 5.04, and both of these for the quarter as well as year-to-date are better than our target of less than 5.3, and we'll continue, as we always do, to strive for zero, but we do set the targets. The top two injuries for the quarter are struck by or against and slips, trips, and falls. And wanted to clarify, just so you're aware, the struck by and against injuries are when an employee strikes a body part against an object. And some of the common objects may be doors, gates, or other pieces of equipment. And this category does not include injuries related from collisions. Both our bus operators and, in general, mechanics, such as those that work in rail car maintenance, bus maintenance plant, or elevator escalator maintenance, are the top two groups that are injured. The primary actions taken to reduce employee injuries have focused on these groups, as we'll continue to do, and one of the things that we do look at focusing on. Such actions include working with bus transportation to reinforce safe and prudent driving behaviors, and bus training to develop a bus ergonomic program that focuses on such things like stretches and techniques that can be used to prevent overexertion and repetitive motion injuries. We have field trained over 500 employees in body mechanics, and that incorporates proper lifting techniques, ergonomics, and slip, trip, and fall awareness. The principal messages of these partnering and training efforts speak to the underlying causal factors of recent employee injuries, which include some inattentive employee actions and not following prescribed techniques or procedures. And these training and outreach efforts have contributed, we believe, to a drop in the number of employee injuries from the last quarter, including those on the groups that we have been focusing on. To the customer injury rate. For this quarter, also July through September 2012, the customer injury rate was 1.4 injuries per million passenger trips. The year-to-date rate is 1.72. Both, again, the quarterly and year-to-date are better than the target of less than 1.9 injuries per million passenger trips. This quarter's customer injury rate is also the second lowest recorded in the past 2 years. The top two injury types are slips, trips, and falls, and where the other wasn't vehicle collision, this is vehicle collision-related reported injuries. And one of the things I'd like to even note, early in October, I did respond to one of the accidents where eight individuals had claimed injuries. And the operator stated to me on the scene that two of the individuals had stated to her that, oh, this is a Metro accident, we're going to get some money, although we're not hurt. So I just kind of wanted to let you know that those are included in our stats because people do claim injury and may not be injured. Our bus passenger, rail facility occupants, and escalator passenger injuries are the leading customer injury groups. To address the bus passenger injuries, safety is working in concert with our bus drive cam team to identify any incident hotspots. Once hotspots are verified, staff are deployed to the locations to reinforce the safe behavior to our passengers and operators and to ensure the areas are clear and free of debris or any kind of objects. And those we actually work as a team effort going out and addressing. We're also conducting passenger service assessments, which evaluates bus operator performance, and that's primarily for new operators, and provides safety-oriented coaching opportunities for the bus operators. To help reduce the number of escalator safety incidents, we continue to inspect escalators, focusing on side panels, comb plates, which have contributed to injuries. We conduct monthly station inspections, focusing on areas that contribute to customer injuries, including ensuring walking surfaces are clear and that means of egress are clear of construction and maintenance equipment. The number of bus and metro access passenger injuries has dropped toward the end of the quarter, and this is due to an increase in contributing collisions, a decrease in contributing collisions, while the number of passenger trips has remained the same. A slight decrease has occurred for escalator injuries, and rail facility injuries have remained the same. Future efforts will focus on defining the root cause of not only the customer, but employee injuries as well, which will help improve our focused or targeted safety initiative efforts, where we're looking at taking real-time data and deploying resources and working accordingly to address the issues in the hotspot areas that I'd mentioned. Moving to our corrective actions report, year-to-date, January through October 18th, and we're going through that. That was our last capture meeting. 119 corrective action plans have been closed. To note, as you can see, from 2004, we're down to only two open caps. Both of those are NTSB recommendations. One is for the external door handles for emergency responders, and the other is for the rollback protection. And we're hoping to, you know, to get that, you know, those actually addressed fairly quickly to address those two issues. 2007, there's only three corrective actions left. And most of these, as you see, are the long term. That one deals with the authority-wide configuration management and working to address that. 2008, there's only three corrective action plans open, and one is from the Eisenhower-DuPont Circle
NTSB investigation, which addresses deployment of technology to alert wayside workers, and that's currently underway with a program that our engineering group is developing in-house, because we need a program that works in our tunnel and our subway system. 2009, there's one corrective action plan open, and that was related to the Fort Totten accident in the NTSB. In 2010, there's one that's open that did not include the 2010 triennial audit, because that didn't come online until later, and that was addressing reports from frontline employees concerning fatigue, and as you're aware, we're working on our fatigue program and our hours of service guidelines. In 2011, we had 317 total corrective action plans. Many of those were from the TOC triennial, as well as our own internal safety audits. Of those, 253 have been closed, 64 remain open. 2012, we had 71 items that were added, predominantly from internal safety audits. Of those, 32 are closed, 39 remain open. And even as recent as the month of October, we successfully closed 15 more corrective action plans, you know, with the cooperation and support of the Tri-State Oversight Committee. So we continuously work to identify hazards as they're found through internal safety audits as well as other audits, but also to close out what we do find in a timely manner as quickly as we can. The last slide that I had in the safety report shows you the hazard resolution matrix that shows from the two items that are left in the unacceptable category, which would be catastrophic or probable or catastrophic and occasional, and both of those come from the safety analysis from the Fort Totten, first doing the analysis and then implementing the recommendations
from
that.
And those are the
analysis.
Two items we'll be discussing in this meeting. So they are really the top priority safety needs that are out there that have not yet been fully addressed.
And Mr. Kubitschek will be providing more information on that with the ATC. So I think you'll see a lot of activity is going on in addressing these items. We do have 64 caps in the undesirable category that are being addressed. Those would include such things as removing the 1,000 series rail cars, which, as you're aware, we have the new 7,000s on order, and I believe most of you have seen the mock-up version. So looking forward to that. That falls in that category. 34 caps that are acceptable with review by the Executive Safety Committee, and this report is also presented at the Executive Safety Committee, and we look at, you know, items that we work on addressing. But again, we want to prioritize dealing with the most hazardous first. And the last 13 are acceptable that we've determined that are ones that are, you know, can be maintenance type issues that are not serious. An example would be we don't have a standard operating procedure to cover vandalism or graffiti remediation at power substations. One that's none of us like to look at the graffiti, but it's one that that we're carrying as an acceptable action that's on the list. So hopefully we're going to be closing those out also.
The acceptable does not mean we accept the existence of these. It means we can close them without a significant review. We still hope to close them.
Yes, sir.
With priority to those that are more serious, but absolutely, not totally ignoring those that are less.
Correct. And that would conclude our quarterly safety report, unless you have any questions.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Doherty? Next month, we will have a discussion of fatigue and where we are on that. I would hope it also will include the issue of bus driver fatigue. Great. If there are no further questions, we will move into the second half of this meeting. Let me open it up with a couple of comments. We'll hear in a moment what these are. I hope they don't go off during our discussions. In my view, this is the most important meeting we have had of the Safety Committee. When you think about those two unresolved catastrophic recommendations, it's something we've got to deal with. We have to have, to be comfortable in running the system, an automated train control capability that does what it needs to do, keeps the system running, keeps separation of trains, but also operates in a fail-safe manner. And a fail-safe manner means if it has any difficulties, if there are any problems, the system reverts to the safest possible mode. as you have, for example, in the braking system, where the air that keeps the brakes working, if it's lost, the train stops. In this particular system, as we learned to our tragic regret in Fort Totten, the system did not revert to its safest possible mode. It reverted to even more unsafe mode by saying there's no train ahead, train behind, you can go at full speed. That's just obviously not the way the system can work, and the Safety Board's recommendation was top-to-bottom review of design, performance, maintenance, and then secondarily undertake such changes as are necessary to bring the system to a point where it's safe. Our goal, and we'll hear this from Dave, is not merely to Band-Aid the vintage system that we have. Remember, this train control system in this property is 1960s technology, basically what was put in BART in the 60s, adopted here. It's not what you would put in today, but it's what we have. But I think there are ways in which it can be made better. Not, again, not just put a Band-Aid and say we're back in business, but what is the safest system we can put out there. Also, we need to keep in mind automatic train control is far broader than automatic train operations. Automatic train operations are good for customer comfort, are good for efficiency, but they are not the heart of the system. The heart of the system is protection and separation and assurance that we won't have catastrophic incidents. Train operation is desirable, but only when we can do it safely. Train protection is essential. It's what we really have to do in the system. The responsibility for reviewing this is clearly a technological requirement, both the staff and outside consultants, and I think some future look by totally disinterested parties will say, from a technical standpoint, what's the best we can do. I'm not suggesting that this committee substitute its judgment for the technological people, but really establish a level of comfort that we've looked at everything that needs to be looked at, we're comfortable with what's being done, and we're providing whatever funding may be is necessary now or may be necessary in the future so that we've fulfilled our responsibility to the customers to have that system out there that we can all rely on. We're going to get an update from Dave on what has been going on. A lot has been going on, and I think we'll learn from it, but particularly those on the board who were not here after Fort Totten, immediately or even a few months after. There's a lot of learning curve in terms of what this train control system is and what it does, and we're going to have a refresher on that today so that we're all up to speed on what our expectations should be about the system that is the heart of safety for our customers. Dave?
Thank you, Mr. Downey, and good morning. Thank you for having me here. To my left, I'd like to introduce Mr. Nick Croce. He's our Deputy Chief of Train Control. He's been with us for about a year. We were lucky enough to recruit him from another agency, and he's hit the ground running. He's doing a great job, so he'll be assisting me along the way, and during the course of this presentation, we'll talk about the importance of why he's down here. One of the things I just wanted to kind of give a quick overview, because there is so much discussion about what is automatic train control. Sometimes people really talk about, well, it's kind of like a traffic light system. And I guess in some ways that is, but I really want to come across to not to understate the importance of what this system does and how technology is there and how sophisticated this is. What this automatic train control system does, basically, it establishes safe distance between rail cars. It also basically has the intelligence simultaneously. It's supposed to know where they're at. It's supposed to be monitoring the acceleration of the rail car. And it also, at the same time, is monitoring the deceleration or safe distance between those. So if we have 140 train consists out on all these alignments, that is what this system is doing. It is monitoring speed. It is issuing commands for you to slow down. And inside our train cars, for example, when we're operating a manual mode operation with automatic train protection, basically it posts, you must not go above 35 miles an hour. If an individual tries to go over that 35 miles an hour, it sounds an alarm. This is from this happening in milliseconds, going over hundreds and hundreds of miles of wire throughout everything. If an operator does not recognize that command, what this technology has, it has the ability to enforce a penalty. It will slow it down, and if you refuse to basically acknowledge the command, because it's even sensitive to see if there's a brake command that was requested, it will bring the rail car to a stop by design. Okay? The same thing is like with distance, and again, what it's looking at is acceleration, the safe distance between cars during acceleration. And the other thing we have to come into mind here, when this system was designed, we have gradient, 4%, 6% grant down, super elevation. So this entire system and profile is based off of this. So whenever we're moving 500,000 tons down 6% grade at 50 miles an hour, that safe braking distance is shortened and recalculated versus if a rail car was going in reverse direction and it was actually utilizing that gradient braking while it was going uphill. It's very, very sophisticated. Now, for automatic train operation, it's basically just the next step above. It still uses automatic train control, but all it is basically we just flip one more switch, and the operator, not to discredit what they're doing, but they pretty much can take their hands off, and this system does all the thinking. It does not, the operator doesn't have to use the master controller. The system itself is basically slowing these things down, breaking these things down, or it's providing the command for the acceleration. Literally, technically, you might have heard it before, and not to alarm folks, but that's why we also like for folks to be in there, because just in case something was to go wrong, the system is thinking. It doesn't recognize if there's a person in the train or not. Its sole purpose is to move people or move assets around the region. So once it gets a door closed command and stuff, technically, it could operate. So that's just kind of a brief overview of what this is, and what we're facing, what we're working through. If we could go through the next slide. Okay, restructuring of the organization. Just to provide a little bit of history, whenever I was first recruited out here, I started off as a chief mechanical officer. I was just taking care of the rail cars, like a lot of great folks. We've had an opportunity to come and work here and see what's taking place. This agency, and it's been stated by even some of the board members, whenever they got through with the construction of the system, we started underinvesting in engineering. It was all about just service. It was deferring of maintenance. It was deferring of engineering and everything else. There were a lot of things that basically the thread and stuff started being pulled. Not to the fault of anybody, but it's just, you know, that's just a statement of fact and what was taking place. It was very alarming. Part of this restructuring is that there was a move even prior to the incident about creating a group called the Transit Infrastructure and Engineering Services. Basically what that was to basically pull engineering and maintenance together, and it's basically in a format where these groups have to work together on these very, very sophisticated pieces of equipment. It's an uncompromising position. There are no shortcuts that can really be provided. We had different disciplines in different areas, and coming in on my part, it was very uncomfortable. Unfortunately, 2009 did happen. It helped justify it. And also with the support of Mr. Sorrell since then, he's helped strengthen that even further. It cannot be understated that, at least on a personal perspective, it has to stay this course. And for us to be safe and for us to look at our customers, for us to be able to look at the board members, and even our own employees and stuff, it has to have a very rigid structure, and there are no shortcuts that can be provided. It's just not worth it. And that's part of, for example, like with Nick, one of the things that we did with engineering, I have a discipline specific. I have a system maintenance group that is working on train control, but I also have an engineering branch that is specifically aligned for the train control, the design, the programs, everything else that's taken place. This is what they do. This is their specialty, throughout. We do that with power. We do that with infrastructure. We do that with our construction as we work with our capital and everything else, and we're trying to line these departments up. At first, naturally, anything is not 100% easy, nor is it perfect, and there's some good learning curve and stuff, but I think based off of our capital stuff that we're doing, some of the things that we're presenting and showing to y'all, there's significant work that's starting to pay off on that. What I have in front of me, this is the new module. This is what's being installed. This is what's being talked about. We figured we'd bring this in for those that haven't had the fortunate tour of going into a train control room. What we have over here to our left, this is the Gen 2. This is the unit that we are replacing in the process that, you know, that had the issue. I do apologize. All right. One of the things also, I apologize on our board action information document. I know there was a lot of technical stuff in there, but we didn't want to understate it. One of the things we put in there was a ferrite choke. Okay. What's a ferrite choke? Okay. This is it. Basically what it is, it's a filter. And one of the things why I just wanted to state that or bring this in is this was done by our engineering group. It wasn't even an NTSB recommendation. This thing is designed and it was utilized on this Gen 2 module. And pretty much what it did, it was another precautionary step, and it helped help filter the signal, which we're trying to avoid from a parasitic oscillation perspective. That's what this device and stuff is. Every train control module that was of a Gen 2 nature, no recommendation or anything else, has already been fitted. As we go through and change all of these things, this is part of our retesting, and we'll talk about that on our presentation and stuff as well. But these are little bitty steps that are not really called out in any engineering perspectives. These are things that our staff has come out after the fact and has started making these hard recommendations. Now, a little bit more on these modules and why we need so many of them. What happens is that this module will monitor a certain segment, say, for instance, about 1,000 feet. All that it really cares about is the 1,000 feet, its primary, and then it communicates with another set that's adjacent to it, basically, so there would be another module, say, for instance, for the other 1,000 feet in front of it. And then there would be another module, which its mate, 1,000 feet, you know, to the other side of it. These devices are just sitting there back communicating. Where's the train at? How fast is it? You know, what's taking place? What kind of command and stuff was out there? So you don't really see these where, you know, one of them takes care of everything throughout, and that's why you have so many of them. And again, it goes back to the process of different gradients require different distances. And so basically these things are literally tuned for each specific area. Even though they're a very generic type product that can be utilized in a certain area, once they're plugged in to their specific environment, that's what they live, breathe, and think to monitor and work and to regulate. So if we could go to the next slide. This one right in here was really just important. It was not only just the technical side of us reorganizing this, but it's also about with safety and with the transportation group. Working in this maintenance environment, working in this operations environment, it is truly a 24/7, and every department has to be actively engaged. Everybody's a stakeholder. From the stuff that we've shown y'all in our train control, at Carmen Turner, where we have the new alarms and everything else, transportation, the control center, they have to respond in a certain way. Our maintenance staff has to respond in a certain way, you know, across the board. I'd also like to point out in the picture, it might not be 100% clear, but these are our actual employees. This is us working with new standards. This is us actually, you know, developing new things that come across. And I also like to, for example, the importance of this also. Whenever we undertook this, engineering has tools, equipment, everybody, you know, they generally have a little bit higher end than what the regular maintenance folks do. But one of the things that we did go through is that even to the level of tools, specialized equipment and stuff, maintenance and engineering signed off on each other. So that way, whenever we were analyzing, if they were taking an exact measurement, we knew the brand of tool that we were working with, and both groups were aware of what was taking place. Beforehand, you'd have one person using one product, one person using another product, calibrations and stuff not, you know, being really adhered to and everything else, and also the training and the investment for these folks to really work these things. Very, very critical. Training and the investment. Because we do have the talented staff to do it, but we've got to make sure that we keep investing in them. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, some of the things that, you know, that's come out of this. A lot of times there's a reference to the FRA. They have some great, you know, some great materials, great standards. But I can tell you right now that they were just, for us, was just a reference standpoint. We have standards that we feel very strongly that are a leader in the industry. We basically have taken the basics. We've sampled a little bit from everybody. But a lot of the in-house activity stuff that we're working off of, it's specifically designed for the WMATA system based off of its duty cycle, its life cycle environment of what's taking place, and what we subject this system to. Basically, not only was it just a matter of the standards and the protocol, but it's also about how often we really test this equipment and the frequency of it. Who's actually trained to do it? You know, how do you go about training these things? How do we document these things? The history is also very important for us to basically to see how the systems and these equipment and stuff perform, because as we've seen here, we have severe flooding, then we go to extreme cold, then we go through extreme heat. These systems have to be perfect every time, regardless of that environment. And that's where our staff comes into place to take care of that. Okay, we'll talk a little bit here on the next slide on NTSB recommendations. One thing I just wanted to point out in this picture should be on the right-hand side. A lot of times people just think train control's in a room. A lot of times people think it's just at a switch point. We have manhole covers. We have stuff going through tunnels, conduit, under ballast, over bridges. We have a litany of things. This connection point right here in this ballast area is just as critical as what this room sits in, because if it doesn't have a complete circuit or if you compromise that, you have an issue. It's also about the type of materials and products and stuff that we work with. Extremely, extremely important to put out there. I can tell you on the system safety analysis, we've received two draft reports. At this point in time, what they have come in and they have reported to us, we have not, at this point in time, seen anything that we haven't been prepared for. We have definitely went above and beyond. I'll give you a for instance. So some of the things that we've looked at where we separated the communications, that's part of the reason why we brought up this one with the ballast here, is that when the system was originally built, they put telephone lines and the train control system on the same kind of connection point. Practice today, other recommendations and stuff, you don't do that. We did not wait for that. So literally what's happening, we've got manhole covers that have been taken apart, ballast that's been taken apart, and basically we're realigning it towards train control is in this environment, radio communications or telephone communications and stuff is over in this environment. True separation and isolation, not a mixed environment. Again, this is hundreds of miles of wiring and stuff, and this is a point-by-point effort that must be, you know, must be stressed. I would say as we move forward, the one thing that we're also looking at on this on the report is, as we look at the draft, is validating, you know, our frequency of our inspections, the way that we've been approaching our equipment purchases, the type of materials and stuff. Are there any other things out there that we really need to address? But like I said, we're very, very pleased to date that we really feel very confident that the right steps, the right measures and stuff were in place, and the team that we've assembled and the team that we're also growing and grooming is approaching this in the right manner, which is very, very important as we move forward. If we could go to the next page. The replacement of the Gen 2 track circuits. This item has been closed, even though we're not done. I mean, the red line, in all practical purposes, done. Everything is being finalized in the month of December. And now we're starting to work on the orange line. And let's see here, I had a reference sheet. For example, on the orange line, We still have orange-blue line. We have 27 train control rooms to do, and that represents over 900 and close to 920 of these. And then also on the yellow-green, we've got 9 control rooms. It represents about another 220 or so of these rounded off. Why do we bring this up? Is because the NTSB, with their aggressive nature, for them to approve our program, even though it's not 100% complete and stuff, sends a strong message that they see that we're taking safety very serious, and the commitment that by the board and y'all support and stuff has helped us achieve that. So it's greatly appreciated. I mean, it's very, very critical. The other component of this is the train control, or the, you know, loss of shunt or track monitoring tool. This for us, I guess, in a sense, might be kind of like a crown jewel of us for train control. It was approved on its first submission to the NTSB. I mean, it is just, it's a great, great thing to be part of. We have, and now since we have this approved, I can tell y'all that we have on a regular basis people across the United States and across the world wanting to come here to look and see what we're doing in our train control. We view ourselves as leaders. We might not be 100% perfect, but we're up there pretty high. And we also understand that we cannot be complacent, because there's always something out there that, you know, that could be a little bit smarter than us. But at this stage of what we've assembled, and that is just massive. I mean, because as Mr. Downey was talking about, we're dealing with 1960 technology that we're replacing. And basically the platform, what we utilize is an 800 megahertz. It's kind of an industry-wide term. A lot of systems and stuff use it. You hear a lot of new systems talk about, you know, communication-based train control, all the wireless things and everything else. There are so many systems across the world in the United States that use 800. It's not a bad system. It's not a bad platform and stuff. It's service-proven, and it's been working very well for a long, long time. And from what we see here at WMATA, at this stage, we have so many other infrastructure needs. We need to spend our money in the traction power. We need to spend our money in addressing concrete and a bunch of other things versus the train control, because we've got the newer technology. This, for example, over here, the Gen 2 is much more of a analog type process. This is all digital. This is at least 21st century technology that, you know, is registered and supported at this time. Next slide, please. The other thing that I'm not sure how many of y'all have seen this picture here before, but this is actual Dulles. So this was another thing that was also taking place. Here it is. We've got, you know, the Silver Line coming on board. Back in 2009, I issued a letter to the Airport Authority telling them that we had certain NTSB recommendations, and they had to adhere to them, along with us also working with the industry. It's basically, the process has taken 3 years to work with the Airport Authority to get the studies and the analysis of what's taken place to make sure that what we're doing on the WMATA system now, that we feel comfortable with the system that we're working on inheriting. For example, the loss of shunt or loss of train detection tool, it is an uncompromising position by this agency. It has to work on their system just like it works here. There's just no compromise. It's the way it has to be. And this is not just talking about revenue period. This is talking about whenever we start putting our folks in there and we start ramping up at pre-revenue testing. I don't want to wait at the last minute and flip it up on there the night before. It's not the right way for us to do this type of business. So the Airport Authority has been supporting us and their contractors and stuff. And again, I would say between the lawsuits that have naturally been taking place, you know, there's been a lot of stuff. Nick and his team, they've traveled a lot of miles to go look at a lot of materials and stuff firsthand because of the proprietary nature of this, the sensitivity of this. Some of these things they can only view in a room with another set of lawyers. But we have went to that extent to make sure that we are comfortable as not only on our existing system, but what we're looking at to try to inherit here from the Silver Line. I will not say we're 100% done with everything, nor will we ever be 100% comfortable, but I would say the necessary measures and stuff are there. Kind of the next steps, two major steps for us. modules on the red line, and all practical purposes, it's done. But what we need to do now is we need to finalize this draft report. We need to go through it, and we're, our next phase will be working with the National Transportation Safety Board, with Jim and the Safety Department, and also the TALK, and anybody else that's going to be, you know, interested in what's taking place. That effort is, has to be addressed, and that is the next step for, you know, going back to an ATO operation possible, you know, on the red line. But again, there's other steps that have to be, you know, addressed at that stage. The other thing that's going to happen in parallel, as Mr. Downey indicated and I commented, and also to Mr. Sorrells, I'm bringing in an independent, kind of like an independent of an independent. I never would have thought it would have been so difficult to find somebody who's never worked here at WMATA and didn't have a vested interest. So we have went globally to try to find somebody. So as we work with these recommendations, working with our staff and stuff, I'm bringing in additional resources and stuff that's going to start looking at this finalized product and look at these steps. The other component that I also wanted to communicate with y'all is I also communicate with the president of the union, you know, about this because of the sensitivity nature of this as well. I've had provided some briefings and stuff with her and her staff because naturally a lot of her employees and stuff are doing this frontline work, which is great. You know, they're the ones that are working this. They're the ones that are being trained, invested in everything else. But we also understand the sensitivity that whenever we do go to that point in time, ATO, everything really has to be perfect and everybody has to be comfortable and on board of what's taking place. And I know I went a little long, but that concludes my report.
Thank you for the report. Thank you for all the work that's going into this. As I said at the beginning, there's nothing more important in terms of the long-term safety of the system. Are there questions? Giancola.
Thank you for the report. I have to add parasitic oscillation testing into my vocabulary now. Couple questions on these units. What's the useful life or failure rate that we're being told by the manufacturer exists on them? And are they internally have surge and power fluctuation protection? And then finally, what happens when it fails? You know, is it automatically go back to a control center? You know, give us some dialogue on that, would you, Dave?
Okay. I'll go backwards on this. It's failure mode. Basically, it should have a fault, and it sends out a command to stop. And again, it doesn't use an analog type signal, which parasitic oscillation was easily to kind of follow along. It uses a very choppy pattern. So basically, if this thing defaults, its first instance is to stop. And then happening in parallel, it sends a message into our AIM system alerting us that we just had some type of fault there.
And does it require any recalibration or resetting at all with regard to failures or power surges, or is it done automatically?
The power surge process, you know, with it being a digital unit, it's fairly robust. But since part of its sensor area is dependent upon out in the track bed and some of the pictures that we've told you, that's why we're looking at our different frequencies of inspections and everything else, because the bonds that are physically in place where it's reading from, they could change with, you know, even to a point now that we have to look at tractive effort or traction power. You know, how much power, because that's another component of this. When we look at the rail, not only is it just about the rail to run the rail car on top of it, but the rail is also part of the return for the traction power, and also embedded in the rail is the signal and train control. So we have all these layers that we have to work against as well. And then the service life of these things.
Manufacturer hasn't given you a service life on it?
We'd have to get back to confirm with you 100% on that.
And how many, ultimately, of these units will be in our system, total numbers?
There's roughly 2,300, okay. And that's not including
those. And we'd also kind of like to comment, too, we have, they're using an Alstom product, Gen 4. This is an Ansaldo Breda product, and so just to clarify, you know, with, like what Mr. Downey was talking about, it's the 800 megahertz product line that we're working off of, but there's several manufacturers that use this. And so that's the other complexity of this, is making sure that everything is truly integrated properly.
Yes, Tom.
2,300. What's the unit price, Dave, on these boxes?
I think the project overall, I think we were about over $70 million.
Okay.
For a project. I'd have to get back to you because that has a lot of other things broken into
just
it.
Just to follow on, thank you for the report on automation. What's, if, could you explain, is there a warranty on this?
Yes.
And what's the warranty?
Standard 1 year.
1 year?
Yes, sir.
Well, then there's, I had another question then. If we got to put 2,300 of these things in, so we're going to have some that are old from, and some that are going to be new, and what's the window? What window are we talking about to get the 2,300 all in?
We probably need probably another 2 to 3 years to finish out the rest on the other alignments. And the other component... Wow. Again, it gets, we're mixing in between revenue service. We have a short time frame. Whenever we go out to calibrate these modules and stuff out there, we cannot have train movement. I mean, it's just not safe. And so whenever we do have the...
During shutdown periods.
Yeah, and that's why the shutdown periods, for example, we've accelerated in those areas, excuse me, because we've been able to do more.
Thank you. I wasn't on the board during the tragic accident that happened several years ago, but as I understand it, what happened, what went wrong, was a malfunction that you didn't even know was possible in the system. The malfunction, the nature of the malfunction was not even something that you knew was possible to happen. I think you've done a very good job, and I very much appreciate the report, on taking care of all of the things that we know have gone wrong. In terms of sort of risk management, how do you creatively think about additional things that could possibly go wrong that we don't even know are going wrong at this point? We don't may perhaps don't even know the kinds of things that could possibly go wrong.
Two areas. One, that's why the system safety analysis by the NTSB is so very important. And then the other component is that's why I want to bring an independent of an independent to kind of overlook everything that we've approached it to see if we've missed anything at this stage. And I've, like I said, I'm not 100% comfortable. Always looking and thinking, just like with Nick, they're always looking and thinking, what if? But we look for looking for additional resources for that.
So one of the functions of this independent person is to sort of take a new look at everything and try and think of additional things that you have not thought about.
Absolutely.
To quote Secretary Rumsfeld, and I don't usually quote him, but those are the unknown unknowns. You have the known unknowns, but it's the unknown unknowns that can come along and hurt you. Sure.
I think it's so important to have the technical piece, even though we don't need to do the technical piece. But I also think the other part is in slide 34. That is the restructuring of the organization. That is how the integration of this works throughout the organization so that we're clear that when one part identifies a challenge or a problem or an issue, that it's integrated with the others to ensure that that follows through, because that was certainly a piece that was a critical piece missing. So it is all of that, the technical as well as the organizational piece, that has to come together so significantly.
Yeah, we really appreciate y'all's support as well, because without it, you know, we couldn't have done this to take this aggressive nature of these steps and also to sustain it, which is vital for this agency.
Yeah. You mentioned that the one-year warranty. After the warranty runs out, do you have a service contract with the manufacturer in case a problem comes up, or is there internal staff that address
it? Yeah, that's some of the stuff that we're looking at on our business model. Say, for instance, with this older technology, there was a lot of work and stuff that was done in-house, or they would send it out to vendors and stuff. The level of complexity with this digital era now, it's best for us to, if we see a particular board that fails or anything else, to ship it out to them, also based off the liability and stuff with that.
Just following up on that, as we put new equipment in and it has to operate effectively with older equipment from other manufacturers, do all of the parties sign off on the configuration, and how do we maintain configuration control?
Yes, I mean, that's part of the reason why Nick is here and the other structure. And then, as we've commented beforehand, we utilize, at least inside the maintenance functions, a common Maximo database where we're tracking all of our materials for work orders and stuff. And then also through the investments, we're utilizing a product called Documentum. Basically, so all of the information that we assemble, all the final documents and stuff, they are not hard copy bound. They are electronically, and we're able to scan even signatures and everything else into that. And so we're definitely going into the virtual age of that. And it also helps us communicate to all of the departments and all of the staff, because if you've seen, you know, we got 9 or 10 yards or locations, you're 24/7 with 7,000 people. Trying to slide this piece of paper around to everybody is not always the best interest. You probably still have to slide the paper, but you have to rely on the electronic bulletin boards and a lot of other things as well, including training.
Yeah. Thank you. I really enjoyed the presentation. I love the show and tell. In looking at the summary, I was really taken by a sentence here regarding the redundant monitoring of lost shunt conditions. Basically, it says the track circuit monitoring tool that was the foundation to ensure integrity, but also importantly broke down silos within the various departments and allowed the organization to work together to a common goal. The introduction of technology has created a greater spirit of teamwork across departments. So I think we know that crisis is a powerful influence in change and transformation. And one of the best trainings I ever experienced was patterned on Apollo 13. And so I guess I'm curious to sense what you think was gleaned from this experience, the learning from how this happened in your unit. What did we learn from it, and how are we able to capture that and replicate it across the ages? I think it's a wonderful sign of the transformation happening. But how do we capture that and replicate it in other places?
I can share a kind of an aha moment. Probably be the best way is one of the things is working with is that, you know, everybody has great opinions and views, but when we work with this, this is about facts. You know, it's like I use the word uncompromising. It's about facts. So as we started developing the loss of shunt tool, loss of train detection tool, one of the things is we've got a track department. We're working on track. We've got a power group and engineering. And one of the things that came out of this comment was the surface finish of the rail. And basically what happens is that for us to have regular detection, that the rail needs to be very smooth. Well, within the rail, and this is about the head of the rail, the top of the rail that you see on any rail, there's sometimes, you know, you have like pitting, you know, there's like imperfections where it's been worn or anything else. And so as started this process, the engineering said, well, we think that we need to have a new surface finish requirement because based off of this new tool, we're seeing, since it samples every second, we're seeing a momentary loss of train detection. And literally we filmed underneath the rail cars as well just to see how the cars were tracking. So engineering was going out there, and naturally the track was saying, well, this is probably a little too much. It's a lot of extra work. We're not sure if it's there, if it's worth the effort and stuff. And plus, you know, the transportation says, you know, we're here to run trains. Well, they went out and they did an area, say, for instance, 1,000 feet, and it worked several locations, and this is an infancy stage. So they went out and they ground this area where they were known to have problems. They came back in. It still had problems. Well, the email started flowing. Engineering had a view. Track was beating themselves on the chest. We told you this is not the right thing. Power was happy, everything else. And I was dealing with a lot of nice energy comments between people. And I said, okay, since this is a third party that helped us, are we sure that we ground everything perfectly? And everybody got real quiet. And I said, well, send us emails. I think everybody needs to go do a walk. They went and did a walk. They went and walked the section, and there was an area of probably about 3 feet that was not addressed. The loss of shunt tool was able to pick. It was so sensitive. It was still picking up the area that was not dressed. They went in, and they re-cleaned everything up, and a moment went away. So everybody kind of sat back in their chair a little bit and said, looks like this is pretty interesting. And so then the other component is that we've also talked about, how much we wear, when will the event come back? That's another thing. We got people now predicting, when will it come back because of the amount of wear and stuff that we do. But I would share that with you. That's kind of an aha moment where you have all these departments and views and everything, and so much is at stake, but it's this little bitty simple things. And, you know, it was a galvanizing moment. Not that we still don't have issues and, you know, great passion, but it just went to show the technical nature of it and about how accurate and how perfect that this needs to be done.
And how much it has to integrate the efforts of lots of
use. Yes.
Mr. Downs.
I just want to make clear while you were talking about Silver Line and an insistence on standards. When the Silver Line Phase 1 is completed, they will have 100% exactly this equipment to your specification for the Silver Line Phase 1.
What they will have a different vendor, but I referenced the word 800 megahertz. They're using the same system within the same same line of business model in Gen 4, and we would be comfortable based off of what we've seen integrating it because they're just as robust.
Is there a reason or a rationale for another vendor if we're looking at uniformity on technology and guarantees and engineering?
At this stage, since the agency is working with, you know, we're working with 800 megahertz, the two primary vendors that we're working with, they're doing a good job with the products. I don't know if it's really, at this stage, the performance is there, you know, the reliability is there with us having this redundance tool and stuff. And, I think there's other investments that are probably more prioritized that the system needs. And I would hate to try to kind of take away a piece of equipment that I feel comfortable with that's working, knowing that I need to do work in the tunnels, like with stud bolts and fasteners and everything else. And I would also add that the other systems that I've worked at as well, you do see other integration and stuff as well. Naturally, they're not quite as large or whatever, but what we're going through here, it's not uncommon practice or whatever. It's just making sure that you loop this stuff together properly.
Is technologies may fail, but the ultimate failure is the human systems that support and monitor and evaluate. And I think it's really important to have as much a human systems evaluation going forward about quality, integrity. If there's ever a role model that you could look at about a system that has been unable to successfully master this environment, it's the air traffic control system for a whole variety of reasons. And there are a lot of lessons to be learned there about implementing state-of-the-art technology and human systems. This is a human systems engineering challenge first, after all of this is done.
Yeah, that's why we stress like the training of the people, the investment into the staff, because it's like anything. You could have the best equipment in the world, but if the people don't have the confidence or they don't have the knowledge, it's just another piece of equipment.
Particularly when you're, as Mort points out, you're dealing with the unknown unknown.
Yes.
I think one of the things to be very sensitive to in the reviews is what is going to be established as the standards of performance and the measures of success out there, so that your human system reacts if anything is not performing up to standard.
Yes.
There will always be failures. That's the nature of this. The question is, what do you do about them? How do you minimize the frequency of them, but also how do you react to them if they are out there?
DeVolter. Speaking of unknowns, back to the Silver Line. So we got another vendor giving, I find that fascinating as an unknown that I now know about. Just from bringing Silver Line, do we have a MOU from the airport authority that their vendor that they selected or whoever selected is, you know, going to work at all costs, risks with our vendor?
Yes, sir. I mean, that was part of why earlier in my presentation I commented that we slid them a letter basically telling them that they had to go through a complete safety analysis at their expense and basically to help validate, because if they were not able to, for example, and they were not able to prove to us, then they might have been having to put these things in.
Well, I don't understand what, you know, if we're buying 2,300 of these things, why didn't they get on our procurement? Wouldn't they saved a lot of money, or somebody would have saved a lot of money if they were on one bulk procurement?
Their procurement was vetted before ours. And again, and another thing, since it's a different company that's building it, there's a lot of other things.
Why didn't we get on their procurement and save some money?
As Dave mentioned, their procurement came before us. Then we had the issue with the Fort Totten and the analysis of what went wrong. We had one vendor, the one that had supplied the original equipment, that was in the process of upgrading their equipment, their design, and had to prove the performance of it. It happened to be that the Silver Line project had picked that vendor, but we would not accept the original product without the system analysis that was done, and in fact the upgrades that they had to do to provide a product that would work on this system and work safely. It's frankly to everyone's advantage to have more than one vendor who meets the standards. It's very important. It's not compromising the standards. It's not having different standards. It's having the same standards and meet it and then assure that they can work in the system. And that's what they've been going through for quite some time, to do that kind of analysis to assure us, and they provided the analysis to us to assure us that, in fact, they're meeting the same standards that we have.
Final question, Mort. Go ahead.
I assume that doesn't mean that we'll get to a point where we mix and match components within a particular segment of the system, but what you're saying is in an isolated segment of the system, which is the Silver Line, you can achieve the same level of performance and operate in the same fashion, but it doesn't mean that you can just pick something off the shelf and plug and play. In that case, I think one of the things we are achieving is the competition that keeps business interest in producing a product, supporting a product, and delivering it at a reasonable price.
Well, the unknowns, as we've got, well, what other stuff is mixed and matched here on the Silver Line besides these 2,300? I mean, is there other technologies that the Silver Line is going to have and we're not going to have? What is this? Mean?
It's the same technology platform, but for example, let me use like the traction power. Yeah. They're using the same products that we are, that we're replacing now. So we definitely look for commonality, you know, across the board as much as we could. So we're very sensitive to, you know, like they're using the different textures, different pavers, different products and everything else, because we do want to minimize our maintenance stuff as much as possible. So.
Any other questions? I think this has been very helpful. When you do have
your independent review, I think the board would benefit from hearing from that person. Because, again, bottom line is you have to be comfortable with it. We have to be comfortable with you in terms of the right decisions being made. So the more we can stay on this, I think the better we'll all be served. I'm also pleased that the safety board is going to continue to look at this, and it's been very responsive in terms of what they need to do, but they're not going to jump the schedule. They'll take the time they need to take. I have a traveling road show with one of the safety board members. We've done it 3 or 4 times. Recently we did it last month out in Los Angeles, largely for an audience of public utility people, the Edison folks, but it's really looking at before and after, the comfort level that they have, but the heart of it, as far as they're concerned, is that this agency and this board is taking the responsibility seriously, and they're willing to hold this up as a national model of how things should go.
Is there no
other business, we'll adjourn the meeting of Safety and Security.